Executive Power, Disc 10.
Chapter 60. President Hayes sat behind his desk, with a phone to his ear, while his national security team sat on the couches and waited for him to join them. Kennedy was sitting next to Valerie Jones, pretending to read a file. In truth, she was listening to what the president was saying, or, more accurately, what he wasn't saying. The senior senator from New York, a state the president had barely carried, had called to advise him not to come down too hard on the Israelis for their incursion into Hebron. Hayes didn't even want to take the call, but Jones had practically demanded it. When he was up for re-election, they would need New York. This was not the first call placed to the White House this morning on behalf of Israel. The powerful Jewish lobby was in crisis mode, trying to avert a potentially disastrous vote that was to take place at the UN later today. Every member of the National Security Team had fielded at least two calls from influential power brokers pleading the Israelis' case. Secretary of State Berg had been solicited the hardest, followed by Chief of Staff Jones and then Secretary of Defense Culbertson. Even Kennedy and General Flood had been hit up. "I'll take it all under advisement," said the president as he looked at nothing in particular. Hayes listened for a few seconds and then said firmly, "I fully understand the gravity of the situation, Senator. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have work to do." Hayes slammed the phone down in its cradle and shot Valerie Jones an extremely unhappy look. Getting up from behind his desk, he kept his eyes on his chief of staff and said, "That's the last one I'm taking. These people are more concerned about Israel than their own country." "What did he say?" asked Jones. "Pretty much that if I want to win New York next time around, I'd better make sure this French resolution doesn't make it out of the Security Council." Hayes chose to stand rather than sit. "And if things weren't already bad enough, they went and sent tanks into Hebron, American-made tanks, I might add." "Sir," started Jones, "I think we need to focus our efforts on getting the vote delayed." Hayes ran a hand through his hair and then grabbed the back of his neck. "B?" He looked to his Secretary of State for an answer. "From what I'm hearing, the French are hell-bent on putting this to a vote now, especially since the tanks rolled in last night."
"Let's not forget about the suicide bombs," interjected Secretary of Defense Culbertson. "That's how this all got started. Israel has a right to defend herself. And if the Palestinians are going to locate their bomb factories in residential neighborhoods, then no one should feel too bad for them when one of them blows up."
The Secretary of State ignored her colleague and said, "Mr. President, I would never argue that Israel doesn't have the right to defend itself, but the reality is that the UN is fed up with this never-ending cycle of violence, and the assassination of one of their own has galvanized the entire assembly like nothing I've ever seen before." Culbertson moved to the edge of the couch.
"But there's no proof Israel had anything to do with the ambassador's death. In fact, it's preposterous to think they'd do such a thing."
The president turned his gaze on Kennedy. Now was the time to let the rest of the team in on what only a few knew.
"Irene."
Kennedy closed the folder on her lap and looked at the secretaries of state and defense and General Flood. The president had been very specific about what he wanted her to say, or, more precisely, what he didn't want her to say. There was to be no mention of the mysterious man who had met with Prince Omar. The Brits had quite an extensive file on the brother of the Crown Prince. While they felt that he was somewhat business-savvy, or at least wise enough to surround himself with people who made good decisions, the Brits also felt that Omar was a bit dense. Their initial opinion was that they doubted Omar could be involved in something as complicated as the assassination of a UN ambassador. So for now, Kennedy was sticking with what they knew to be fact. In a voice barely above a whisper, she said, "There was no bomb factory in Hebron." Secretary Berg stared at Kennedy. "Did the Israelis admit to this?" "No, in fact, they are standing by their story." Culbertson asked suspiciously,
"Then how do we know there was no factory?"
"We had satellite coverage of the attack. There were no secondary explosions."
"Then where did all the damage come from?" asked Berg.
16 Hellfire missiles fired by Apache helicopters."
"American-made Hellfire missiles," added the president, "fired by American-made Apache helicopters."
Secretary of State Berg made the connection first.
"That's why they went back into Hebron last night. They wanted to clean up the mess.
Or, said Kennedy, knowing Ben Friedman, they'll plant the evidence to make it look like they were telling the truth the whole time and the Palestinians were lying.
Or, contradicted Culbertson, they simply went back into Hebron to clean out these martyr brigades.
I'm sure it's a bit of both, agreed Kennedy, but right now I'm inclined to believe one is a pretense for the other.
The reality, said the president, taking control of the discussion, is that we have an ally who is not being truthful with us.
What is Friedman saying about the ambassador's assassination? Asked Berg.
Kennedy looked at the keen Secretary of State. Berg was well aware of Israel's official denial of any involvement in Ambassador Ali's death. Her question by itself showed that she believed Mossad capable of conducting a brutal version of their own foreign policy.
The Director General is denying any involvement.
Culbertson grimaced. Just because they lied about the bomb factory doesn't mean they had anything to do with the Palestinian ambassador's assassination.
I'm not so sure, replied Hayes. At a bare minimum, however, it proves that we can't take them at their word.
Culbertson turned to Kennedy and skeptically asked, You don't really think they would have done something so brazen, do you?
Kennedy took a moment to compose her thoughts.
I don't see the benefit of such an action. At least, not here on American soil, but then again, I don't have all the facts. For all I know, this could be the start of an all-out offensive on Israel's part to clean out the West Bank once and for all.
Why kill the ambassador, then? Asked Berg. All they've managed to do is galvanize the UN.
Until this moment, for several reasons, Kennedy had restrained herself from voicing her next comment. First and foremost was that she didn't want to believe Israel could be so reckless. But her strained relationship with Friedman and the assault of the suicide bombers on the Israeli psyche led her closer to the conclusion that they were indeed capable of such a brutal move. There is a school of thought, Kennedy couched her words carefully, that Israel no longer cares what the UN thinks.
The president had not heard this before and asked,
How so?
To be sure, there are elements within Israel that believe engagement is the only way to lasting peace and security, but there is a growing lobby that thinks every time Israel trusts her concerns and security to another country or organization, she gets burned.
Secretary of State Berg concurred. They see the UN at a bare minimum as being unsympathetic and at worst as blatantly anti-Semitic.
Kennedy agreed. So, by killing the Palestinian ambassador in New York, they're telling the UN what they really think of them, while at the same time sending a message to the Palestinians that they can be every bit as brutal as they are.
Culbertson started to see their point.
UN resolutions go unenforced all the time, so why bother trying to appease them?
Exactly, replied Berg.
Chapter 61 The armor-plated Mercedes limousine came to a stop in front of the north entrance to the West Wing. Two spit-polished Marines stood at attention in their dress blues, one on each side of the door, like sentries to an ancient palace. Prince Abdul bin Aziz stepped from the black limousine and buttoned his suit coat while ignoring the reporters who were shouting questions at him from the lawn on the other side of the driveway. The cousin to the crown prince had left his keffiyeh back at the embassy. In fact, the only time he wore the traditional garb of his people was when he returned home or was forced to do so because of ceremony. Over the last 54 years, the ambassador had spent more time in America than Saudi Arabia, which was fitting since he'd been born at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. His early schooling had been handled by tutors, and then, at the age of 14, he was shipped off to Phillips Exeter Academy, the ultra-exclusive prep school in New Hampshire. After Phillips Exeter, it was on to Harvard for both his undergraduate and graduate degrees. Abdul bin Aziz had a great affinity for America. More than anything, though, he admired his host country's secular approach to governance. He had seen the true evil that could be perpetrated by men with deep religious conviction, and it scared him. This was why he owned 3 homes in America and rarely allowed his children to return to Saudi Arabia. Prince Abdul bin Aziz believed that in his lifetime, the House of Saud would fall. It would be trampled by the very fanatics his relatives had supported over the years. The ultra-Orthodox Wahhabi sect of Islam had spread like an unruly weed across his country and beyond, choking out all forward and rational thinking, silencing all dissenters within and without the faith, and damning millions of people to a belief system that had more in common with the Stone Age than the 21st century. And now, in this dangerous time, he was once again sent to the White House by his cousin, the Crown Prince, to try to appease the fanatics without slitting their own throats. Chapter 62. The entire security team was tense. 20 or so protesters stood on the other side of the heavy black steel gate, but that's not what concerned Uri Doran, the man charged with protecting Israel's ambassador to the United States of America. It was the camera crews, two of them to be precise. Doran had been with Shin Bet, Israel's internal security service, for 18 years. The organization was the rough equivalent of the Secret Service and the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. He'd learned over the years that cameras were far more dangerous than any bullhorn, sign, or brick. Through simple editing, he and his people could be made to look like jackbooted thugs. The Metropolitan Police had dispatched two squads to help deal with the crowd, but their presence did little to abate Doran's worries. He'd watched Washington's finest in action before, and with a record number of lawsuits for police brutality in the past few years, the men and women in blue were not about to forcibly subdue unruly protesters and put their careers in jeopardy. To make matters even worse, Washington was a town filled with professional protesters who knew exactly when and how to provoke a confrontation. When forced to move, they were prone to pratfalls and overly dramatic wails of pain, as if their limbs were being twisted to the point of breaking. All of this was done, of course, right in front of the cameras, to elicit maximum drama for the nightly news audience. Doran clutched his tiny digital two-way in his hand and looked out across the embassy grounds at the protesters. For now, they were acting somewhat civilly, but as soon as the ambassador's armored limousine began to move, they would go nuts and rush the gate. For a moment he longed for his days in Argentina, when the police would simply turn the water cannons on the crowd and be done with it. This was America, however, and he could hope all he wanted, but such a thing would never happen. Sitting out the storm would be the best course of action, but the ambassador had told him this was not possible. His presence was requested at the White House, and given the current state of affairs, it was a request he could not ignore. One of Doran's men had suggested sneaking the ambassador out the back way in one of the security sedans, but the head of the detail had dismissed it for two reasons. The first was that the ambassador was too vain to show up at the White House in a mere sedan, and the second was that none of the sedans were as safe as the ambassador's armor-plated gas guzzler. They would just have to gently inch their way through the crowd and fix the dents and scratches later. Doran stepped back into the embassy to find Ambassador Eitan nervously pointing at his watch. The Shin Bet officer reluctantly nodded and brought his radio to his mouth. He alerted his team that the ambassador was coming out, and then after waiting a moment, he escorted the ambassador out the door and quickly into the back seat of the black limousine. The random course to the White House had been chosen, and the lead and chase sedans were in place. The heavy vehicle rolled slowly toward the gate. From his position in the front seat, Doran could see the protesters begin their surge. Doran resisted the urge to grab the Uzi submachine gun from under the dash. They were simple protesters and nothing more, he told himself. He radioed his team, reminding them to stay calm. They'd been through it before. The gates slowly started to open, and the group immediately pressed past the four police officers trying to hold the line. Doran's orders were specific in one regard. If any protester was foolish enough to try to run through the open gate, they were to be immediately brought to the ground. Having witnessed the efficiency of Doran's men before, all of the protesters stopped short of the curb. The lead sedan nudged its way through the crowd, creating a path for the limousine, which stayed right on the sedan's bumper. The protesters collapsed in around the limousine and began acting like berserk chimpanzees on some safari tour gone bad. They were hammering the limo with their signs, and although Doran couldn't see it, they would also be scratching the paint job with car keys. Out of nowhere came an object that caused Doran to freeze. He could do nothing but watch. It was against all standard security procedures to open the door. The metal cylinder was hoisted over the shoulder of one of the police officers, and then a mist of bright orange paint began to coat the front windshield and the side of the car as the limousine kept moving. As the three-car motorcade broke free, Doran swore to himself and pressed the transmit button on his two-way, telling his people back at the gate to make sure the culprit was arrested. He would press charges this time and make sure the idiot received the maximum penalty allowed by the American courts. The ambassador would want to stop now and clean the paint. Under no circumstance would he want to arrive at the White House with a freshly vandalized limousine. Doran would put his foot down this time, though. There was no way he was going to stop in a non-secured area to clean the car. The Secret Service had a pressure washer available for just such a problem, and it could be taken care of in mere minutes in a very secure environment. The limousine's internal phone buzzed, and Doran picked it up.
"Yes."
He listened to the ambassador complain for a few seconds and then said,
"No."
The ambassador was used to getting his way. He began to demand that the car be cleaned. When the ambassador had run out of breath, Doran said,
"Mr. Ambassador, we are not stopping, and that is final."
Doran hung up the phone and let out a frustrated sigh. He dreaded the confrontation that would take place later when they got back to the embassy, but he knew he was right. It was his job to worry about security, and the ambassador's to worry about diplomacy. Chapter 63. The president rose to his feet, and so did everyone else. He crossed the Oval Office and warmly greeted the Saudi ambassador. Clasping both hands around the prince's, Hayes said, "Mr. Ambassador, thank you for coming by." Kennedy immediately noticed the forced smile on the Saudi ambassador's face. He was not looking forward to whatever it was that he'd been sent to say. She watched cautiously as the ambassador went around the room shaking hands. He was not his normal, charming self. He barely made eye contact with Secretary of State Berg and Secretary of Defense Culbertson. He was slightly better with Valerie Jones and Michael Hake, but he only acknowledged General Flood and Kennedy with a slight nod from afar. When the president and the ambassador were seated in the two chairs in front of the fireplace, everyone else took their place on the couches. Despite the president's warm welcome, a chill fell over the room almost immediately. Prince Abdul bin Aziz was looking at the ground, waiting for someone else to speak. Valerie Jones filled the void by announcing,
"Mr. Ambassador, we would like to assure you that we are taking the assassination of the Palestinian ambassador very seriously."
The Saudi ambassador kept his head down and looked up at Jones from under a pair of dark eyebrows. "And what are you doing about the recent attack on the civilian population of Hebron?" Jones immediately retreated from the diplomatic arena. Such a blunt question could only be handled by the president or the secretary of state. It was Secretary of State Berg who spoke first.
"Mr. Ambassador, we are not happy with the recent developments in Hebron and are putting as much pressure on the Israelis as we can."
The ambassador was careful to give Secretary Berg a skeptical but respectful look. "Madam Secretary, you either underestimate your influence over your allies, or you have yet to exert the proper amount of pressure."
"Trust me, Mr. Ambassador." Berg glanced at the president for a second and said, "We are exerting a great deal of pressure on Israel."
"Then why, may I ask, is Hebron still under military occupation?" Before Berg could respond, Secretary Culbertson said,
"Because three suicide bombs killed 31 Israelis yesterday, bringing the 12-month total to 178 dead and over 500 injured."
The Secretary of Defense let the cold statistic hang in the air. Aziz clasped his hands and sat up a little straighter. "The violence is never ending. Somewhere, somehow, it must stop."
"I agree, Mr. Ambassador," replied President Hayes. "But you must agree that Israel is not acting without provocation."
"The other night, when they bombed that neighborhood, killing hundreds," Aziz shook his head, "they were not provoked. No one in the room dared use the Israeli excuse that they were taking out a bomb factory, and it was a good thing they didn't, because after a long moment of silence,
the Saudi ambassador added.
We have received intelligence reports that say there was no bomb factory, as the Israelis have claimed.
Ambassador Aziz turned his dark eyes from Secretary Culbertson to Kennedy and asked,
Director Kennedy, can you confirm or deny this?
Kennedy was caught off guard by the ambassador, but didn't let it show. Not wanting to appear a bald-faced liar, she said,
We have heard the Palestinians' claims, but so far have been unable to verify them.
He kept his gaze locked on Kennedy.
And what of the Palestinian ambassador to the UN?
Kennedy badly wanted to tell Aziz that his cousin, Prince Omar, was a suspect, but that would be unwise. Besides, they had nowhere near enough evidence to make that connection. As recently as this morning, Kennedy and Rapp had discussed the possibility of Friedman sending one of his agents to Omar and setting him up. Friedman had made a career of running very complex operations that looked like one thing and turned out to be something very different. If Omar was about to be the patsy for an Israeli operation, they would know soon enough.
Answering the question put to her, Kennedy said, We have absolutely no idea who killed Ambassador Ali, but are running down every possible lead.
Including that the Israelis may have done it?
Including that the Israelis may have done it, answered Kennedy.
President Hayes cleared his throat.
Abdul, I value your friendship, and I value the friendship of your country. We have made great strides as of late, and I think we need to keep moving in the right direction.
And what is that direction, Mr. President?
Hayes looked momentarily miffed by the question.
Peace and prosperity. We need to continue to open up our markets to each other and work toward forging a long-lasting relationship.
And what of the Palestinian crisis?
I've made myself very clear that this administration supports a Palestinian state.
Secretary of State Berg quickly added,
As long as Israel is recognized by the Arab states and her security is guaranteed.
Hayes nodded earnestly.
Good, said Aziz. Then we can count on you to vote for the French resolution this afternoon.
The silence was deafening. And after a long, awkward moment, the ambassador began to shake his head.
Must you always favor Israel?
He said this in a desperate voice that was barely loud enough for the room to hear.
Mr. Ambassador, said Secretary Berg as gently as possible, you know better than anyone how complicated this is.
Yes, I do, he sighed, and unfortunately, it is about to get a great deal more complicated.
Aziz turned to President Hayes.
My government is requesting that as a token of our friendship, you vote for the French resolution for Palestinian statehood this afternoon.
President Hayes swallowed hard and began to sadly shake his head.
Abdul, I need time.
For what, Mr. President? So you can try to convince the French to table their resolution?
It was now Aziz's turn to shake his head.
The time has come, Mr. President, to stop the bloodshed. The time has come for you to show that America can be even-handed in this regard. I plead with you, Mr. President. The Arab people need to see that you will break with Israel when they are wrong.
Berg tried to draw Aziz away from the president.
Mr. Ambassador, I can assure you that the American people want peace in the Middle East, but it cannot be rushed.
Madam Secretary, I can assure you, in turn, that the Arab people want a Palestinian state, and they are tired of waiting.
Aziz turned back to Hayes, and with genuine sorrow said,
Mr. President, I take no joy in telling you this, but I have been asked to inform you that if America vetoes the French resolution this afternoon, there will be severe repercussions.
Such as? Asked Hayes.
Aziz took a deep breath and announced, The Crown Prince will suspend all oil shipments to America immediately, and he has been given assurances by the other OPEC Gulf states that they will do the same.
Chapter 64 The ambassador's words hit home with an impact that rolled through the minds of the presidential advisers like a series of shock waves. No one spoke. There was nothing to say until the ambassador was gone. President Hayes had all but pleaded for the ambassador to give them more time, but the ambassador had been firm. It was time for an even hand and bold steps. Waiting a week or a month served no purpose other than to allow Israel to find a way to hold on to the land. Kennedy watched as Valerie Jones escorted the ambassador from the room. The president's chief of staff followed him into the hallway in a desperate effort to get him to reconsider. Kennedy didn't need to be told what to do. Getting up from the couch, she walked over to the president's desk and picked up the handset of his bulky, secure telephone unit. She punched in 10 digits and waited for Charles Workman, her deputy director of intelligence, to answer. On the third ring, she got him.
"Charlie, I need an immediate intel pull on everything we have over the last 48 hours between Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states concerning a possible oil embargo against us if we veto the French resolution at the UN.
Kennedy listened for a moment and said,
"No, it's firsthand. Ambassador Aziz just informed the president of their intentions."
Again, she listened to her DDI and then replied,
"That's right. Use every asset we've got. I need some hard intel within the hour."
The director of the CIA returned to find a shell-shocked president and a very agitated Secretary of Defense.
"Mr. President, this embargo could be construed as an act of war."
"That's interesting, Rick," chimed Secretary of State Berg. "That's what the Japanese said when we placed an oil and steel embargo on them back in 41.
The president looked to Berg, ignoring her historical comparison, and asked,
"Are they bluffing?"
Berg, who seemed to be taking the news better than anyone else, said, "I'm not sure, but the Gulf states do have a history of false bravado."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning they might be unified at the moment. But who knows what next week will hold? Some of them are in the red, a few are barely in the black."
Berg gestured with her hands that it was a toss-up.
"I can't see a unified embargo holding for very long. We need the oil, and they need our money."
"We can't allow this embargo to last a day,"
announced National Security Advisor Hake.
"The mere mention of it could precipitate a worldwide recession. Markets would plunge overnight 10% to 20%.
"But what about our reserves?"
asked Culbertson.
"We can increase our imports from Venezuela and Russia and the former republics, and if we have to, we can drill in Alaska."
"Who says Venezuela and Russia won't go along with them?" replied Hake. "And besides, all of that will take time. 2 months from the onset of the embargo, we could probably get back to near normal supply levels, but that's not what worries me. What worries me is the devastating effect it would have on an already strained economy."
Hake turned his attention to the president.
"The last time they really hit us with an embargo was in 73, and it took us a decade to climb out of the hole."
Valerie Jones hurried back into the room, catching the end of the National Security Advisor's comments. She quickly added,
"And we ended up with interest rates at 17%, runaway inflation and unemployment approaching double digits. Mr. President, we cannot let that happen again."
Her implication was clear. If the embargo was put into effect, any chance he had at serving another 4 years would be dragged down with the floundering economy. Looking back at Jones, Hayes asked,
"What did he say when you walked him out?"
"He says they are resolute in their decision. Now is the time for a Palestinian state."
Hayes sighed.
"We have no choice."
The defense secretary wasn't quite ready to give in.
"Sir, let's engage the French and see if we can get them to delay the vote, even a day or two. In exchange, we could demand that Israel withdraw its forces from Hebron."
Hayes shook his head in desperation. The French would never go along with such a plan. They had center stage right now, and were not about to miss the opportunity to ram Palestinian statehood down Israel's throat.
"Sir, we can't do it this way," Culbertson stated with great conviction. "Israel will never honor the resolution until a real ceasefire is in place, and they have been given assurances from all the Arab states. We need time to make this work."
"Unfortunately," said Hayes, lifting his head, "we don't have time. Let's at least try."
"I agree with Rick, Mr. President." Secretary of State Berg looked at her watch. "The vote isn't scheduled to take place for another 5 hours. We should see if we can get a withdrawal in exchange for a ceasefire, maybe even propose a peace summit in Paris for next week."
"All right, see what you can do with the French."
Hayes motioned for them to get started, and both cabinet members got up. The president turned his attention to Kennedy.
"Is there a chance the Saudis are bluffing?"
There's a chance, but I think there's a better chance they're serious. I put a call into Charlie to find out what we've picked up in the last 48 hours. If they've been talking, we should have picked something up.
Chapter 65. David sat in front of his monitors and sipped a bottle of water. Everything was going according to plan. The traffic cameras were all online and working properly. His media source had confirmed the ambassador's appointment at the White House, and the world was watching. Washington, D.C. was about to be rocked, and David couldn't have been more pleased with how things were playing out. As he'd predicted, the Israelis had sent their army into Hebron, and the international community was busy filing protests. Palestinian suicide bombers were throwing themselves into the breach and making the Israelis pay the price. French Ambassador Jussar was playing his hand perfectly at the UN, and if Omar had been successful in convincing his brother, the Crown Prince, that now was the time for an embargo, the United States would be boxed in. All that was left to do was raise the level of violence one more notch, and his lifelong dream of a free Palestinian state would be a reality. The black limousine came into view on the predetermined screen in the upper left corner. David put the bottle of water down and glanced at the remote firing device sitting in the heavy black case on his right. The bomb was already armed and ready to go. All he needed to do was pop the clear safety cover and press the red button. The limousine made a turn and showed up on the next screen. David tracked it carefully through the city. It was close to the White House. The explosion would undoubtedly be heard by the president, and the Secret Service would go into lockdown mode. David watched with great anticipation as the limousine neared the crucial intersection. At this point, everything depended on its taking a right turn. David wiped his sweaty palms on his pants and counted the seconds. The vehicle began to slow, and then, just as anticipated, it turned onto Virginia Avenue, midway between the State Department and the White House. David breathed a brief sigh of relief and looked to the next monitor, his fingers poised above the keyboard, prepared to manipulate the traffic light two intersections away. He could see the parked van, now visible on two of the monitors. He entered the proper command and held the traffic light on red for another 15 seconds. The limousine's brake lights came on almost immediately. David popped the plastic cover on the remote firing device and waited. The long black vehicle inched its way into position, and then, when it was a few feet short, David reached over and pressed the red button. Chapter 66. Rapp appeared in the doorway of the Oval Office with Secret Service Special Agent Jack Warch. Rapp caught his boss's attention and motioned for her to join him in the hall. Aides and staffers were now coming and going, shuttling back and forth between other members of the president's staff and cabinet. The political machine was coming together for a unified assault on forestalling the UN vote. Kennedy excused herself and joined Rapp and Warch. The Secret Service agent led them across the hall and opened the door to the Roosevelt Room. Rapp thanked the head of the presidential detail and promised to keep him informed. Kennedy studied Rapp suspiciously and asked, "Keep him informed of what?"
"Our John Doe, who met with Omar and then flew to New York. Well, Olivia just found out that he left Penn Station at 10:05 the night Ambassador Ali was killed."
"And where was he?"
Kennedy stopped short, knowing the answer before Rapp finished. Rapp nodded.
"He arrived at Union Station early Tuesday morning, just before 2.
The director of the CIA studied her top operative, wondering what to make of this unusual development.
"Why would he come here?"
"That's a good question, and I'm not so sure I can answer it."
"I assume from what I heard you say to Jack that you warned him of a potential threat to the president?"
"Yep. I just wanted to make sure the president wasn't making any scheduled public appearances today."
"So you think he's come here to kill again?"
It was obvious by the expression on his face that Rapp wasn't so sure.
I don't know, Irene. It could be something as simple as a pre-planned escape route. Rather than try to leave the country and get caught, come to where you're least expected to go. She could tell Rapp didn't buy his own line of thinking.
What do you really think? What does your gut tell you?
Rapp struggled with it for a moment and then replied, I think he's come here to do another job.
Or, Kennedy added, he lives here.
This was an entirely new line of thinking. There were plenty of former Special Forces guys living in the surrounding area, at least a few of whom were guns for hire, but there was something about him that was distinctly un-American. A certain look similar to his own. Most people would never notice it, but it was what gave Rapp the ability to blend in when he was operating in the Middle East and Southwest Asia. He thought about the guy being an American and said, "That's a possibility, but if the guy lived here, he would be more familiar with our capabilities, in which case I can't see why he'd risk being seen on camera."
"It's obvious."
"He doesn't know we're on to him," answered Rapp.
"Exactly."
"Or," said Rapp, "we're giving him more credit than he deserves."
"Either way, have Olivia run a check through the DOD files."
"I'll do it, but what about bringing Mossad in on this?" asked Rapp.
Kennedy shook her head. "The president won't allow it. Plus, he still thinks the Israelis are behind this."
"That's nonsense."
"I'm not so sure," said Kennedy with a raised brow. "What if this entire thing is a complex sting launched by Mossad to implicate Prince Omar?"
Kennedy could tell by Rapp's sour expression that he didn't buy it.
"Just think about it for a minute. If John Doe is really Israeli, and they sent him to con Prince Omar into playing the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the one role he wanted more than anything in his life,
what's their end game?" asked an unconvinced Rapp.
"Embarrass the Saudis and draw attention to their support of Palestinian extremists."
"I don't know, Irene," he said, frowning. "It sounds like a reach."
"I'm not saying it isn't. But it's one of several reasons why we can't go to Friedman and ask him who this guy is. I do, however, think it's time to bring the FBI in on this."
Rapp cringed. "I don't know about that."
"If this John Doe is in Washington, we have no choice." He instinctively recoiled against the idea, and it was not a reflection on the Bureau's competency as much as it was on the rule book that they'd bring along. If the FBI nabbed this guy, they would have to play it straight up. Reluctantly, Rapp consented. The two of them left the Roosevelt room and walked across the hall to the Oval Office. At present, there were too many people in the room to tell the president of the recent development. While Kennedy waited to have a private word with Hayes, Rapp called the CTC to tell Terbis to bring the FBI in on the investigation. Before his call could be completed, there was a rumbling noise from outside the building. Rapp instantly tensed, knowing before anyone else in the presidential office that the noise was an explosion. Chapter 67. True to form, Marcus Dumond sat in his corner cubicle, oblivious to the storm that was raging around him. The bullpen at the CIA's counterterrorism center was a labyrinth of 5-foot-tall plastic and fabric dividers. Partly out of necessity and partly out of humor, the aisles that cut through the area had been given names such as Abu Nidal Way and Osama bin Laden. Dumont had been the chief planner and street namer of the ever-expanding bullpen, and he had intentionally located himself on a dead street with limited access. While his MP3 player cranked out the tunes, Dumond worked the keys of his computer with blazing efficiency, toggling back and forth between three screens, closing windows, opening new ones, and shrinking or enlarging others. He was onto something. He wasn't sure what quite yet, but he was definitely onto something. Following Rapp's lead, he'd focused on recent transactions made by Omar's main assistant. The hardest nut to crack wasn't hacking into the secure networks of the institutions in question. That was easy. The real issue lay in the enormity of Omar's wealth. He used literally hundreds of banks to handle his vast fortune.
That said, however, Dumond didn't waste his time surfing through the prince's transactions that were handled by Chase or the Deutsche Bank. In fact, he immediately discarded all banks in the United States, England, Japan, Canada, and Germany, and focused on those nations known for their financial privacy laws. Dumond had only to read the file on Devon LeClaire once to know where to focus his attention. If given his choice, an anal-retentive snob like LeClaire would bank with only one group of people. The ever-efficient Swiss were the perfect match. They thought of everything. They conducted themselves with a respectful, professional flair that properly schooled men like LeClaire demanded. Trying to run searches based on Omar's name or those of his various holding companies had proven to be too cumbersome. Dumond had two strategies he wanted to employ before he called in the money guys from Treasury and the FBI to pore over the account with a magnifying glass. He'd seen the men and women do it before, chasing down every check, wire transfer, and charge to its final destination. It could easily take 50 agents 6 months to run a thorough examination of Omar's finances, and even then they might miss something. They had to do things the proper way, both politically and legally. Even if they knew the tricks that Dumond employed, they would be too afraid to use them. The 28-year-old hacker from MIT could get results much quicker. None of the information he gathered would be admissible in a court of law, but Dumond had worked enough with Rapp in the past to know that he preferred to settle things in a less public forum. Dumond had keyed in on three banks, two headquartered in Zurich and a third in Geneva. Each bank was among Switzerland's oldest and most austere, and LeClaire was authorized access to each one. At first, Dumond focused his attention on the larger transactions, $5 to $10 million. He came up blank. So he started over again, looking for money that had been shuffled between the three banks he was focusing on. This also proved to be a dead end. As a last resort, he went through each account for the past month, looking for smaller transactions from various banks on various days that all may have ended up in a single account. He paid special attention to the name of the banks the money was being transferred to. He was looking for an accumulation of funds in one account that would get him to the proper threshold. Dumond was focusing on blocks of money and transaction dates. In his mind, he was trying to piece together a down payment followed by a later payment for successful completion of contract. He couldn't find anything that was approaching $5 million or even half of that number. Suddenly, an amount and a bank caught his eye. $500,000 had been wired from one of the banks in Zurich on Monday to a financial institution on the island of Martinique in the French West Indies. He swore he'd already seen the same transaction. He began looking back through the transactions, and sure enough, 2 weeks earlier, LeClaire had wired the same amount from another account to the same account in Martinique. As Dumond looked at the name on the account in Martinique, he couldn't help but think there was something familiar about it. His fingers remained poised just above the keyboard, and his head began to tilt to one side. It was coming to him. The name was not that common. Like his own, it was French, which would fit with the French West Indies, but there was some reason why it seemed familiar to him. Dumond pulled his arms back and crossed them in frustration. He had just seen the name somewhere, and it was driving him nuts that he couldn't remember. He was about to give up and have the computer run a search when it hit him. Dumond closed out one of his screens. His fingers flew across the keys in search of this morning's online edition of the New York Times. The home page popped up on his center screen, and he scanned the sidebar for the story he was looking for. After a brief moment, he found it and opened the article. In the first paragraph of the article, Dumond hit upon the name he was looking for, Peter Jussard. He looked back and forth from one screen to the other, from the online edition of the New York Times to the balance of a bank account in the Caribbean containing $1 million. Dumond attempted to calculate the odds that it was coincidence and quickly decided it wasn't. It couldn't be. Yanking off his headphones, he grabbed the handset of his phone
and dialed Rapp's mobile number. Chapter 68. It had taken almost exactly an hour to figure out what had happened. The White House was under lockdown. No one was being allowed in or out. The president and the other principals had all been moved downstairs to the Situation Room. Jack Warch, the special agent in charge of the presidential detail, had originally ordered that everyone be taken to the bunker deep under the White House, but President Hayes had countermanded the order. He'd been in the bunker once before and had no desire to go back unless he absolutely had to. When Warch saw how serious the president was, he relented. At a minimum, he asked that they relocate to the Situation Room. Hayes agreed, and the national security team moved downstairs where they could monitor the crisis and stay in close contact with their various departments and agencies. The heavily armed and black-clad Secret Service counter-assault team had taken up defensive positions around the executive mansion in the West Wing. Stinger surface-to-air missiles had been unsheathed and readied on the rooftop, and Stagecoach, the presidential limousine, was running and waiting on the south grounds, ready to evacuate the commander-in-chief from the premises if necessary. The men and women under Warch's command had reacted with the precision and efficiency that he expected. They'd run the drills over and over until every agent and officer knew not only their own responsibilities, but those of the people who stood next to them. Now the 100-plus person force stood primed and poised, ready for whatever would happen next. As the minutes passed, they began to realize that the White House was not a target, at least not today. The initial reports that came into the Situation Room were that the State Department had been hit by a car bomb. Those reports were quickly proven inaccurate when Secretary of State Berg contacted her office and was told the point of the explosion was actually several blocks away on Virginia Avenue. The first real clues to the carnage were provided by a Fox TV crew that had been at the State Department doing a live shot. After recovering from the initial shock of the explosion, they packed up their gear and hoofed it to the site of the detonation. They were lucky enough to get to the scene before the Metropolitan Police could set up a perimeter. Fox broadcast live footage of fire crews trying to douse the flames of several twisted wrecks. The FBI and ATF arrived 20 minutes later and had the Fox TV crew moved to the other side of the barricades with the rest of the networks and cable outlets. The bomb experts from the ATF and FBI quickly ascertained the exact point of detonation and found what little was left of the vehicle that had been used as the platform. After that, everything was a little confusing. There were shattered windows on both sides of the street for at least a block in each direction. Injured people streamed out of office buildings, many of them with nothing more than paper towels to stem the blood that flowed from gashes caused by flying glass. The George Washington University Medical Center, just a few blocks to the north, was inundated with patients. Fortunately, only a few of them had injuries that were life-threatening. The actual target of the bombing was not immediately obvious. Several cars were flipped, twisted, and charred almost beyond recognition. Many of the buildings had received superficial damage, but none had collapsed. The true target of the attack came to light when someone from the Saudi embassy called to see if the ambassador was still at the White House. The answer was, unfortunately, no. It appeared the ambassador's staff, after seeing the footage, had tried to reach both the ambassador and his security detail. No one was answering their phones. An FBI agent at the scene verified that one of the charred vehicles did in fact appear to be a limousine. It had taken the brunt of the explosion. Torn in half and flung across the street, it was now resting upside down in two pieces on the opposite sidewalk. The bodies inside the limousine were burned beyond recognition. The make of the vehicle was verified as a Mercedes with diplomatic plates. Prince Abdul bin Aziz, the Royal Saudi Ambassador to the United States of America, was dead. President Hayes's range of emotions went from disbelief to confusion to outright anger. When Rapp entered the Situation Room for the second time, the president was absolutely furious. He had been in the midst of trying to figure out what to say to the Crown Prince when CBS broke the story.
The speculation began almost instantly. In the new 24-hour news cycle, it wasn't enough to just report the facts. Talking heads were taking to the air on every station, throwing the names of terrorist organizations around like they were corporations traded on the New York Stock Exchange. So-called experts were calling into question the effectiveness of the FBI and CIA, and the new Department of Homeland Security was being denounced by one particularly self-righteous pundit as a monumental failure. During that initial media scramble to try to get a hold of the story, one lone voice caught the president's ear. A spokesman for the Palestinians wondered aloud if Israel could have been behind the assassination in an effort to delay the vote before the UN and drive a wedge between America and her greatest Arab ally. The story had struck such a chord that even Rapp paused to give it serious consideration. Both he and Kennedy shot each other quick, worried glances upon hearing the hypothesis. If it wasn't for the facts that Rapp held in his hand, he would have been more inclined to believe Israel was behind this entire operation. Prime Minister Goldberg was ruthless and daring enough to launch such a plan, and Ben Friedman was the perfect person to carry it out. If this car bomb got pinned on any one of a dozen terrorist groups, the Crown Prince and the rest of the House of Saud would put their wallets away and begin cracking down on fanatics like they had never done before. The Saudi ambassador and the Crown Prince were very close, having been raised together and schooled as if they were brothers. He was the perfect target, and what better place to do it than on U.S. soil? Several things didn't fit, however. There was this mysterious John Doe seen meeting with Prince Omar twice in the last 2 weeks. There was the audio recording from the Brits that had them talking about war and money, and even more interesting was the sudden appearance of this John Doe in both New York City and Washington, D.C. All of this could be explained away as some exotic operation by Mossad to put the Palestinians on the defensive, stick their finger in the eye of the UN, and drive a wedge between the United States and Saudi Arabia. In a contorted, complex way, Rapp could see why Friedman might launch such an operation. The suicide bombs were not stopping, and in the minds of men like Goldberg and Friedman, action was always better than inaction. All of that fit, with one exception. Rapp held up the facts one more time and read it. This one piece of evidence unearthed by Dumont cast everything else they had in a different light. Rapp was about to tell Kennedy what the young hacker had discovered when a Marine captain came up and told him he had an important phone call. Chapter 69. President Hayes was leaning forward in his leather chair with both elbows planted on the long, shiny conference table that dominated the Situation Room. One hand clutched the white receiver of his secure telephone unit, and the other was placed over his brow to shield his eyes from any distraction. He was talking to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, a man he considered his friend. The prince was someone who Hayes felt truly wanted to see East and West merge peacefully, but was unfortunately saddled with a populace that for the most part preferred religious rhetoric and inflammatory speech over enlightenment and liberty. Hayes knew Crown Prince Faisal and his cousin were close. That made the call difficult enough. But it was also difficult because Hayes was embarrassed. Embarrassed that such an attack had occurred on American soil just blocks from the White House. Just minutes after the ambassador had sat in the Oval Office and delivered an ultimatum that, if not heeded, would put the tenuous American economy into a downward spiral. An ultimatum that certain hardliners in Washington would deem an act of war. The thought of that news alone becoming public caused the president to become momentarily nauseous. The conspiracy nuts and leftist anti-oil crowd would have a field day with that juicy connection. Saudi ambassador comes to White House, threatens oil embargo, and then is killed in explosion after leaving meeting with the president. This would be next to impossible to contain. No matter how innocent he was, there would always be those who would forever believe President Robert Hayes or someone in his administration
had had a hand in the ambassador's death. Hayes, in his attempt to console the crown prince, stated over and over how sorry he was and that he would make sure the perpetrators were caught and brought to justice. Something in the crown prince's voice told Hayes that the monarch did not believe him. As a final gesture, Hayes asked the crown prince if there was anything he could do to help ease the pain. Crown Prince Faisal made only one request, and it was one that, given the current situation, the president knew he could not refuse. President Hayes slowly hung up the phone and, with the expression of a beaten man, said, "Inform Ambassador Briseth at the UN that we will be voting for the French resolution this afternoon." Secretary of State Berg and Chief of Staff Jones were alone with the president in the Situation Room. Both shifted in their chairs uncomfortably and exchanged nervous looks. It was Jones's job to speak first. She had known Hayes the longest and was his closest advisor. In a soft voice, Jones asked, "Robert, what did Faisal ask of you?"
"He does not want his cousin's death to be in vain. He wants me to help make a Palestinian state a reality."
Jones nodded thoughtfully. She did not want to face an oil embargo, but neither did she want to face the wrath of the Jewish lobby.
"I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but don't you think we should talk about it?"
Hayes simply shook his head. "There's nothing left to talk about. I don't trust the Palestinians any more than you do, but the truth is, I don't trust the Israelis either. If we don't vote for this resolution, we'll once again look like we're doing Israel's bidding, and we can't continue to look so one-sided in the eyes of the Arab world."
The Secretary of State cleared her throat and said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, but Israel is the only democracy in a region dominated by dictators, corruption, and a very dangerous strain of religious zealotry.
I know all that, but it doesn't change the fact that we'll once again look like we're favoring Israel. Add to that the fact that the Saudi ambassador delivered us an ultimatum and then his limousine was blown up."
Hayes paused in frustration and through gritted teeth said, "The Arab street will think we killed him. They'll hit us with an oil embargo and consumer prices will skyrocket and our economy will go right into the tank. We are boxed in." "Sir," cautioned Berg, "there are better ways to do this. I can guarantee you that Israel will defy the UN if the French march this resolution through the Security Council. This vote, sir, could very easily lead to open war."
Berg leaned forward, stressing her next point. "We need to get a ceasefire in place first, and then come up with a well-thought-out plan and timetable, or all of this will be a disaster."
"How? The French have made it abundantly clear that they will not delay the vote."
"For starters, let's get Prime Minister Goldberg to pull his forces out of Hebron. And let's get him to do it immediately. The Israeli ambassador is in the building. We can deliver a stern ultimatum and demand immediate action."
"And what about the vote?"
asked a skeptical Hayes. "We'll work on getting the French to delay it."
Hayes lowered his head and thought about it for a moment. The idea of getting the Israelis to pull out of Hebron was appealing, but he'd learned long ago that getting the French to do anything was never easy. Half-heartedly, he nodded his approval. "Let's do what we can, but if nothing has changed by the time the vote comes up, we're going to support it. I see no other choice."
Chapter 70 Kennedy looked at the facts, and like Dumond before her, she tried to calculate the odds of another Peter Jussar receiving $1 million from one of Prince Omar's private Swiss bank accounts. It was Kennedy's nature to be suspicious, and thus she was inclined to lean away from coincidence and toward conspiracy. When she discovered that half of the money had been deposited in the Caribbean account the same day the Palestinian ambassador to the UN was killed, she all but ruled out coincidence. Standing near the duty desk of the Situation Room, Kennedy looked up from the facts and asked,
"Are we doing anything else to confirm that this account belongs to Ambassador Jussar?"
"Marcus is looking into his personal finances right now," answered Rapp.
Kennedy accepted the answer with a pensive nod and fought the urge to race into the conference room and tell the president.
"And this John Doe?"
Kennedy held up the photo taken from one of the surveillance cameras at Union Station.
Anything else on him?
Rapp shook his head in frustration.
All right. Let's go tell the president.
Rapp reached out and grabbed her by the arm. Hold on a second. He didn't like the idea of just dumping this stuff on the president without a game plan. Rapp knew what the president's reaction would be. He'd want to get the FBI and every other law enforcement agency involved, and in the process, they'd stir up so much shit and cause so much unneeded confusion, this guy they were looking for would disappear. Rapp had an idea for a gambit that would allow them to see things as they really were. After making sure no one could hear them, Rapp drew close to his boss and said, "This is what we should do." Kennedy entered the conference room first and announced to the various staffers who were present,
"Principals only, please."
This was code for telling everyone who wasn't at least a cabinet member that something of a very delicate nature was about to be discussed. The handful of aides that were present immediately exited the room, leaving the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff, the President, and Rapp and Kennedy. Neither Kennedy nor Rapp bothered to sit. Kennedy spoke directly to the President.
"Sir, we have a couple of very interesting developments."
Kennedy set the first piece of paper down. "This shot was taken from a surveillance camera at Penn Station in New York City the night that Ambassador Ali was assassinated. And this shot," Kennedy set down a second piece of paper, "was taken at Union Station approximately 3 hours later. The experts at Langley say this man is the same individual the British photographed meeting with Prince Omar, the same man who was picked up on surveillance cameras at JFK on Sunday." Hayes stared at the two photographs for a few seconds and said,
"So, if I'm hearing you right, this man is in D.C.?"
"That photo is from early Tuesday morning, so we can't be sure he's still in town, but..."
"But we think he probably is," replied Hayes.
"Yes, sir."
"And are we thinking he might have had something to do with the explosion this morning?"
"As of right now, I would say yes."
"Do we have any idea who this guy is?"
Kennedy hesitated.
"I'm afraid not, sir."
The president's jaw clenched in frustration.
"What are we doing to catch him?"
"We've checked all of our databases on known or suspected terrorists, as well as everything the Brits have and Interpol. For reasons that are obvious, we have yet to check with either the French or the Israelis."
"And we've come up blank," stated Hayes flatly.
"Yes, sir."
Kennedy made no attempt to soften the truth.
Hayes looked away from Kennedy to his other advisers and asked, "Well, then, what in the hell are we going to do?"
The National Security Advisor spoke first.
"I think it's time we bring the FBI in on this thing, and if we think this guy is still in the country, we should alert all local, state, and federal law enforcement officers. We have to cast a big net and hope we catch him."
"Sir," said Rapp, a bit too forcefully, "I think that's a bad idea." Everyone in the room looked to Rapp. Even the unflappable Kennedy, who knew what they were up to, was a bit caught off guard. Rapp glanced at Kennedy and said,
"Show him the facts."
Kennedy set the last piece of paper down in front of Hayes and explained its significance. Hayes studied the document and asked,
"What are you trying to tell me?"
Rapp answered before Kennedy had the chance, "I think it's pretty obvious, sir. Ambassador Jussar was bought." Hayes frowned.
"Do we even know for sure if this account belongs to the ambassador?"
"We're working to confirm it, sir, but it's a pretty big coincidence." Sitting to the president's right, Secretary of State Berg was replaying in her mind a conversation she had had with her French counterpart. In an effort to get France to delay the vote, Berg had pleaded with the Minister of Foreign Affairs to reconsider. As the conversation played out, the minister had admitted something that was a bit unusual. Berg decided it was time to share her thoughts.
"Excuse me, Mr. President, but I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Rapp."
Surprised by his Secretary of State's position, the president asked incredulously, "Why?"
"When I attempted to get the French to ease off of their position yesterday, the Minister of Foreign Affairs admitted to me that even he was a bit caught off guard by what was going on in the UN.
When I pressed him, all he would say was that Ambassador Jussard had acted without his approval. His excuse for this was that Jussard was a very eager politician and a close friend of the president. In addition to that, pushing for Palestinian statehood was nothing new. The entire country of France overwhelmingly supports the idea.
Hayes stabbed the fax with his index finger. I need this verified, and I need it done fast. If we're going to get the vote delayed, it'll take some time.
Kennedy said, We've got our best people on it. Now tell me why this, Hayes waved the fax in the air, should change my mind about alerting the FBI to this mystery man who seems to be in all the right places at the wrong time.
Because once we do that, sir, he'll know we're on to him.
Hayes let out a heavy sigh.
I don't see how we can possibly keep this from the FBI.
I agree.
Always the political oracle, Jones looked to her boss and added, There will be a congressional investigation into this, and if... She stopped and corrected herself. When they find out you willingly withheld information from the FBI... She didn't bother to finish the sentence. The painful expression on her face said it all. Kennedy had coached Rapp that this would be the most influential argument for alerting the FBI. She'd also told him that it would come from Jones. Ignoring the chief of staff, Rapp focused on the president and said, Sir, all I want is 24 hours. He spoke in a confident tone. Give me a day, and I'll find out who this guy is and what he's up to. The president believed him, but unfortunately they didn't have the luxury of a day to figure out what was going on.
We're out of time, Mitch. The UN is going to vote this afternoon. I'm sorry, but we're going to have to bring in the FBI.
Rapp had him right where he wanted him.
What if I can get the UN to delay the vote for a day?
Hayes was cautiously intrigued.
How?
Chapter 71. Ambassador Eitan had been sitting in the Oval Office for 11 minutes and 38 seconds. The Israeli emissary to the United States knew this because he was a fastidious time checker. Having to wait to see the President of the United States was not an unusual occurrence, but waiting alone in the Oval Office was. Either intentionally or unintentionally, it was very unsettling, and this morning had been unsettling enough. It had started with a frustrating conference call to his superiors back in Jerusalem. They told him to tell the Americans nothing, which was easy enough, since he knew nothing. But incredibly irritating because his own government didn't trust him enough to let him know what was going on. Then there had been the protesters and the bright orange spray paint. His security chief had refused to stop and clean the paint, and as he'd predicted, the camera crews stationed at the White House had descended on the graffiti-strewn limousine like a pack of rats on a garbage heap. And then the most unsettling thing of all occurred, the car bomb. Eitan and his assistant had been shoved into a corner table of the White House mess and told to stay put. They were under lockdown. No one was to leave or enter the White House until the Secret Service said so. While drinking his coffee, he had seen the news bulletins on TV reporting that the Saudi ambassador had been the target. Eitan was not embarrassed by the fact that he felt no sorrow for the man. He barely knew the ambassador, but that wasn't the reason for his lack of sadness. There were plenty of people who he'd never met that he regularly felt compassion for. Eitan was not an insensitive man. He just simply felt that it was about time others experienced the pain that he and his countrymen experienced on a weekly basis. Especially the Saudis, who through their so-called charities supported many of the groups who spilled Israeli blood in the most indiscriminate and inhumane of ways. He had been at the White House for almost 2 hours and was growing more nervous by the minute. The UN vote for Palestinian statehood was creeping closer, and if Eitan didn't deliver his message soon, it would be too late to do any good. His government was depending on him to move the Americans in the right direction. After almost 2 solid years of suicide bombs, the UN was about to reward the perpetrators of such violence with statehood. The United States had to stop such a precedent from being set.
This ends Disc 10.